Welcome back to the show, listeners. We know it's been a long wait for a new episode. However, we think our guest this month will more than make up for it. Standing Post had the opportunity to meet a real American hero in December who risked his life to save Jackie Kennedy and prevent further harm to other individuals during the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. Retired Special Agent Clinton J. Hill was a U.S. Secret Service agent from 1958 to 1975, serving five presidents. Presidents Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson, Nixon, and Ford. There will be no one else like this gentleman in Secret Service history for a long time. But before we begin, I do have one more thing for you. Due to the length of our interview with him, we decided to split the episodes into two parts to capture Mr. Hill's legacy. The second episode will air in March. Listeners, please welcome retired Special Agent Mr. Clint Hill. Mr. Hill, I want to say thank you. I am humbled and honored to have you on the show today. I greatly appreciate you taking the time out of your day to come speak on the episode here for the listeners, to be able to tell us your stories about the legacy that you've had in the organization. But as I always start these podcasts, I want to make sure that for those people that may not know your background, just be able to state who you are and what you've done for the organization.
Okay. It's great to be back here at Secret Service headquarters in D.C. I look forward to always coming back here because it's kind of like coming home for me. My name is Clinton J. Hill. I was born in 1932 out in Larimore, North Dakota. My birth mother had previously had five children. It was the middle of the Depression, and she realized almost immediately after my birth she could not take care of me. And so when I was just about 17 days old, she took me to Fargo, North Dakota, and turned me over to the North Dakota Children's Home. And 3 months later, I was adopted by a wonderful couple, Chris and Jenny Hill, who had previously adopted a little girl named Janice. And they took me to their home in Washburn, North Dakota, and I became the fourth member of that family. And I grew up in Washburn, North Dakota. And when I finished school there and going to go away to college, I was going to study history, and I wanted to become a history teacher. I wanted to coach athletics, so I majored in history and physical education, minored in education, and played football in college and played baseball, some basketball, sang in a glee club. When I graduated, the draft was still going on because of the Korean War. It had just ended, but they were still using the draft. And I had had a deferment while I went to college. And so I immediately received word that I was to report for duty. And the draft board told me where to report, which I did. And they sent me to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. And I was sworn in. I was a member of the U.S. Army. And I received my basic training there. After basic training, they had given me a number of tests. So then they decided to send me to Fort Holabird, Maryland, where the Army Intelligence Center was located. And I went there, and they trained me to be a special agent in counterintelligence. And I really got to really like that kind of work. And the school I went to, really experts. They did a wonderful job. Then from there, when I finished that, they reassigned me to 5th Army Headquarters, which is in Chicago. I got to Chicago, and they decided I should go to Region 9 and 113th CIC Detachment in Denver, Colorado. And so I went to Denver, and that's where I spent my time with the Counterintelligence Corps. Ran a lot of investigations out of that office, a lot of background investigations, clearing people for top secret. The reason that we had a fairly large office in Denver was that there was a facility just outside of Denver. It's top secret. We had responsibility for the security of that facility because they were manufacturing nerve gas. We had a lot of work to do in making sure that employees were not giving out information they shouldn't be giving out.
Right.
And so we did a lot of surveillance work and a lot of background investigations. It was a wonderful experience. So when it was time to get out of there, also while I was there, in 1955, President Eisenhower came to Denver with his wife, Mamie. The reason they came to Denver was that Mamie's mother lived there. He loved to come there, the president did, because he could go up to the mountains to a friend of his cabin and fish for trout, or he could play golf down at Cherry Creek Country Club. While there, he had a massive heart attack. And they put him in Fitzsimmons Army Hospital. Well, I was an intelligence agent with the Counterintelligence Corps, part of the Army, and so we would be out there occasionally and checking on things. And in that process, I met some of the Secret Service agents who were assigned to Eisenhower. And I find that they were just great people, the best of the best. And I decided when I got out of the Army, I thought maybe I could probably try and become a Secret Service agent. So in 1957, I got out of the Army. So I went to the Secret Service office and I submitted my application. And there were no vacancies in the Secret Service at that time. But within a year, one did develop. I was sworn in Denver, Colorado, as a Secret Service agent in September of 1958. And I became one of 269 agents in the entire organization. It was that small.
And during that time, to be able to join the organization, you literally just had to go to a field office and submit there.
Everybody started in a field office.
Okay.
At that time, there were three of us sworn in the same day. I was sworn in Denver, Ron Pontius in Chicago, and Bill Payne in Detroit, Michigan. And we were given what they called at that time a Schedule C appointment, which meant that within the first year, we had to go back to the White House and be evaluated for duty on the White House detail with the Secret Service. So within that first year, I was sent back to the White House, and we all three were, separately, and evaluated. And then in November of 1959, I was permanently assigned to the White House.
And that process, as I was reading through your books, it was almost a kind of a 360 evaluation to where you had a certain amount of time that you had to perform the duties, and then pretty much they all got together and evaluated the performance before they decided they wanted to select you.
That's correct. And it was not only the supervisors, it was the agents who were working with who were part of the evaluation process. And they really made a determination whether they thought you were qualified to be on the White House detail. Because the White House detail at that time was very small. When I was permanently transferred there in the fall of 1959, we three went there together, same date, Ron Pontius, Bill Payne, and myself, and we became the first 10 number 10 agent on each of one of three ships. So it was a very limited number of people that were there.
And at the same time, was there ever in that recruiting process, was it the same way if you kind of had to wait until somebody had made their exit before you were able to go into the group, or were people scheduled to leave, or was it just more or less, how did that process work?
Well, in this particular case, it was an increase of three people to the detail over what it had been. So it didn't require someone being transferred out for our three of us to be assigned there. But under normal conditions, what you said is exactly what would happen, is that nobody came onto the detail unless somebody came off.
As again, I was reading through your books, and talked about one of your first assignments, and maybe this is kind of going back a little bit with it, was President Eisenhower's mother-in-law.
Correct. We had President Eisenhower, his mother-in-law lived in Denver. She was aging. She lived alone in a house, and she had a maid. They had a nurse with her. I guess the nurse was there about 12 hours a day. And so President Eisenhower wanted one of us to be in the house from 7 at night until 7 in the morning. So I was a low guy in the totem pole in Denver. So naturally, I got the 11 o'clock to 7 a.m. shift pretty frequently. I mean, it was rotated all the other agents too, but I was positioned being so low, I was the guy that got it more often than anybody else.
Right.
And it just so happened that on one occasion while I was there, Mrs. Dowd lived up on the state in the second floor. She had a bedroom up there, and when the nurse was there, she would wait to see if she needed any help or not in a separate bedroom. The maid stayed up on the third floor, and we, the agents, would stay on the ground floor, main floor of the house, or we'd go down into, they had a nice study in the basement in which President Eisenhower kept all of his books, and he loved books about the West. Louis L'Amour is an author, and so we would get one of those books and go back up to the first floor where we were closest to the doorways, and we'd sit late all night long. We'd be reading Western novels. But in this case, all of a sudden, about 2 in the morning, Mrs. Dowd calls for the nurse, and there wasn't any response. That was rather unusual. So I waited for a while, and then pretty soon she called for the nurse again. I thought, I better go upstairs and see what's going on. So I went up and walked into the room, and I said, Mrs. Dowd, I'll get the nurse for you. Went into the next bedroom where the nurse was, and she was lying on the bed. And I said, wake up. Nothing. I walked over and I touched her. She was already, rigor mortis had started setting.
Oh, wow.
She was dead. And I thought, oh, God, now what do I do? Because I was really a brand new agent when this happened. So I went upstairs and got the maid, told her what had happened. It scared the heck out of her. Came down, I thought, boy, Mrs. Eisenhower had just been there visiting her mother. She didn't like to fly, and so she was going back to D.C. on a train with her sister. And I figured, boy, about this time, they're about going through Chicago. And if word gets out that there's a body comes out of this house during the night, it's going to be assumed it's Mrs. Dowd.
Right.
And the press is going to run with it. And Mrs. Eisenhower is going to be on that train when she gets to D.C. and gets off. She's going to see a newspaper that says, President's mother-in-law died or something. So I thought, oh, God. So I picked the phone, called my SAIC, Earl Scholl, told him what happened, and he said, no problem. He said, I have a friend who's a coroner. He'll be right over. So pretty soon, this big black car pulls up into the driveway up along the kitchen. The guy gets out, and he opens up the passenger side doors, the front and the back. There was no metal post in this car. He came in and took him upstairs. He checked her, and he said, okay, let's move her down into the car. So we wrapped her up in a sheet, had to carry her down this kind of a winding stairway. It was very difficult. We got her in the car and just laid her in there and just closed the door, drove away. Nobody ever knew what happened. Thank goodness, because I thought, I'm going to lose my job over this for sure. But everything worked out very well. The problem was, when I went from there, I had to go back to the office to do the paperwork.
Right.
And I knew she hadn't died on my duty. She didn't die between the times that I came to work. She died when the other agents were on duty. But I was the one that had to do all the paperwork.
Right.
So I was rather upset. But I was a junior agent, and that's just the way it went.
And I always find that fascinating. Agents on their first duty assignment, I mean, it varies and ranges as far as the experiences and what people have to go through. So that might have been a very surreal moment. I mean, was that a thought in your head? This is what I got myself into, and this is, I got to take care of this?
Sure.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. I didn't want to make a mistake because I knew if I did, that was it. I'd be out.
So the other thing I found fascinating, too, is that the other opportunity you had when being on the presidential protection detail is the travel. And I think that was another big part of President Eisenhower, the time that you spent, was the multi-country visits that you did because of the politics at the time required him to make those trips and everything like that. Was there anything that you might be able to speak on those?
During the Eisenhower administration, we had been traveling on what was then Air Force One, which was a four-engine prop Super Constellation, which is pretty slow. I mean, like traveling from D.C. to Denver, it took much longer period of time than it would today's jet aircraft. So in the fall of 1959, the Air Force acquired three 707-type commercial jets. They made them available as executive aircraft for the White House, for members of the cabinet, and that kind of thing. Well, Eisenhower realized it was going to be much more easy to travel now. In beginning in December of 1959, we left Andrews Air Force Base one day. We flew from Andrews to Rome, did all the events in Rome, from Rome to Ankara, Turkey, all the events in Ankara, down to Karachi, Pakistan, on up to Kabul, Afghanistan, down to New Delhi, over to Tehran, Tehran to Athens. Athens, we got on board a big cruiser, the USS Des Moines, and went across the Mediterranean to Tunisia to see the king. Took that same ship back over to Toulon, France. Got on a train, special train. Went from Toulon to Paris. Got back on Air Force One after seeing de Gaulle in Paris. Flew down to Madrid to see Generalissimo Franco. Then flew to Casablanca to meet with the king. And then finally, we got to go home. I can't remember how many days exactly, but it was a long trip. And for me, it was really the first overseas trip I had ever been on. And so it was very interesting for me. I was very fortunate.
Today's agent has a lot of capabilities at hand, different pieces of equipment that they're able to use to help plan these trips and to be able to provide the best type of protection for the president and any of the protectees that we have when we travel. I guess my question would be is, during your time in this first go at this overseas travel, what did you have to prepare? How did you prepare? And how did you communicate with individuals that when you flew into a destination with the president, how did you coordinate that before they landed?
Everything was much more difficult than it is today. We had no personal communication of any type. And in that time, the Secret Service was strapped for money. We had very little, if any, communications equipment. There wasn't even a communications division in the Secret Service, completely relying on WACA. At the first, it was called the White House Signal Agency, and then they changed the name during the Kennedy administration to the White House Communications Agency. But they provided all the radio equipment. We only had Motorola P-33s. I don't know if you know that. It's a large, like a lunch bucket, or bigger than a lunch bucket, but heavy, and we'd have to carry that around. They also provided telephones wherever we went with a switchboard in the locale, switchboard in New Delhi. If you needed to talk to somebody at the White House, you'd pick up the phone. The operator would answer. You'd tell them, give me so-and-so, and immediately they'd go direct line right to the White House. So they were really fantastic at doing this. I was amazed. We did other equipment. It was really limited. They did fly two cars, usually.
Okay.
That's when that all began. And they were flying in C-130s.
Okay, so it's still with you had the partnership with the military?
Oh, yeah. We had to rely on the military for a lot of things. Not only WACA was Signal Corps, that was in the Army, that was military. Aircraft all came with military. And we had Air Force One, and then there was a backup aircraft. And then there usually were two press planes, two 707s, one from TWA and one from Pan American Airways.
Okay.
So, and there were lots of people travel on these trips. And we went, after that trip, early in 1960, we went all through South America, and we came back from that, and then we went all through the South Pacific, went to the Philippines, Taipei, Seoul, Korea, that entire area. We were supposed to go to Tokyo, but the demonstrations against President Eisenhower in the United States were so large in Tokyo, they had to cancel the visit. We couldn't go.
So today we have standard equipment with the agents and with the UD personnel. During those times, were you able to, I guess, put together equipment to better assist the situation or to be able to answer any challenges when you went into the country?
It was extremely limited. We had very little equipment. We had no body armor at all, and none of the cars were armored. We had no armor, period. We had handguns. We were at that time using a .38. The issue was a 4-inch .38. If you were working, like, for a first lady, you'd carry a 2.5-inch, but there was very limited capability because we just didn't have the equipment.
Okay.
And anything we got, we had to borrow or steal from the Army.
Yeah, that was a common tongue-in-cheek thing. It's beg, borrow, and steal.
That's what we were doing.
Yeah, I think a lot of people can relate to that within the military and just those type of settings or within the Secret Service, too, at the time. So I guess to maybe close out with President Eisenhower, can you sum him up in a couple of words as far as your time and experience with him?
Well, he was a great man. He was a retired general. He always maintained that same composure as a military officer. And in fact, Mrs. Eisenhower didn't call him Mr. President. She called him the general. So, I mean, when she said the general, you knew exactly who she was talking
about. That's interesting.
We all called him the boss, but she called him general all the time. But he was a wonderful man. He treated us like he would treat his troops. He didn't know many of us by name. He had Jim Rowley, who was the SEIC. He knew him. He called him by name. He called him Jim. And the driver of the car, we had one of the guys that drove almost all the time, Dick Floor, and he called him by his name. But other than that, if he wanted you to do anything, he'd just say, "Hey, agent," and he'd tell us what he wanted, and we somehow managed to comply. But he was wonderful to work for. He had a real sense of responsibility, and he was prompt. If we told him we wanted to go somewhere, and it was going to be leaving at 9:30, he was in that car at 9:29:30, ready to go. We never had to worry about a schedule. It was ideal.
And you brought up the special agent in charge, Rowley. Our training center is named after him. Is there anything you'd like to share about that gentleman and working for him during your time?
Mr. Rowley came originally from the FBI, and then he joined the Secret Service. But he had been on the White House detail since, I guess, FDR and then Truman. If you ever see photographs of President Truman out walking, because he liked to go for an early morning walk around the White House and around the city a little bit, and there was always Jim Rowley walking with him. He had the highest respect. Everybody thought the world of Jim Rowley. And he got along well with people like J. Edgar Hoover, members of Congress. So it was really an advantage to work for a man like that. And we all respected him immensely.
You brought up President Truman, that you actually had the honor to meet Mrs. Truman, too, and got to meet her and have tea with her.
That's correct. I also met President Truman, but I met him when he was a former president. But after he died, and we still had agents with Mrs. Truman out in Independence where they lived. And one day, the GSA had set up a trip to go out there to examine the Truman Library, which is being built in Independence, Missouri. And so I decided to go along, and I let the agents know I was coming out there. So they said, "Okay, we'll meet you when you get here. Mrs. Truman wants to talk to you." So I didn't say anything about what I was going to be doing to these other people on the plane. We had a private Air Force plane to take us out there. We got there, and they went to the library, and I went with the agents to see Mrs. Truman. And when I got there, the first thing she asked me, she said, "Would you like some tea?" And she had me sit down in her library, and she went and made tea for the two of us. We sat there, drank tea, and talked for over a half hour. And she just wanted to talk about how much she thought of the agents that were working with her, because she was just devoted to those guys, and they had done a wonderful job. And it was really a pleasure. It was one of the more interesting times in my career.
As you're closing out your time with President Eisenhower, you were now seeing the presidential elections take place, and John F. Kennedy was elected. And I kind of wanted to move into that, or into that time of your life, and just for a little bit. And as far as talking about some of the things over there, obviously the assassination of note is something that did occur during the presidency, but I would also like to reflect on your time there prior to that, and sure, if there's anything you'd like to share about your experiences with the president during his time.
Well, the election in 1960, November 8th, President Eisenhower really hadn't done hardly any campaigning for Nixon. Nixon was pretty much out on his own, and his running mate was Henry Cabot Lodge. And toward the very end of the the campaign, President Eisenhower decided he would go to New York and do some campaigning with Nixon. So they sent an advance team of agents to New York. This is November 1960. I'd been on a detail 1 year, and I was one of four agents assigned to go to New York to set up this trip. And in those days, there were no such things as political advance men. We went to New York, and we had maybe a couple of guys from WACA with us.
So the presidential detail or protection detail would have to go out and do the advances themselves.
We did all the work ourselves. We'd go to New York. We would deal with whether Republican National Committee or whoever it was, a Democrat, if we were working with a Democrat, it'd be Democratic National Committee, the officials there on the site, on ground, what they had planned for the president to do. What did they want him to do? And then we would set it up. And in this case, they wanted him to go to Long Island. They wanted him to go to Westchester County. They wanted him to make a speech in Midtown Manhattan. And they wanted him to go to Madison Square Garden for a fundraiser. So one of the agents went to Westchester County. Another one went out to Long Island. A senior supervisor was H. Stuart Knight, who later became director. He kind of decided to go on each of these sites. And they gave me the motorcade in downtown Midtown Manhattan. The president arrived by helicopter at the Wall Street heliport, got into cars. Nixon's with him. We had an open car, and we're going down through Midtown Manhattan. About 11:50 in the morning, everybody in the office buildings was trying to go across the street to have lunch. They couldn't go across the street, so we had a built-in crowd of millions of people, and everybody else that was in the building was up there with the windows open throwing confetti at us. I mean, it was a nightmare. And for me, I was in the service now just not very long period of time, and only been in the detail a year.
Okay.
I was scared to death, and thank God for the New York Field Office and the Bureau of Special Services and Investigation in New York, and we got through that situation without incident. But I was very concerned. I didn't know how we were going to do it, but we did. Thank goodness everything worked out okay. And then we came back to Washington, took President Mrs. Eisenhower to vote on Election Day, back to the White House. Next morning, we flew down to Augusta, Georgia, so I could play golf at the Augusta National. And after one round of golf, Jim Rowley came to me and said, pick the three of us out. And he said, the other two guys, pack your bags. You're going to Palm Beach, Florida, because President-elect Kennedy is going down there on Friday, and he's going to stay at his father's home, developing who he's going to have for a cabinet. Clint, he said, pack your bag. There's a plane here going back to D.C. Get on the plane, take it back, go to see the chief the next morning, Huey Bauman. But he never told me why.
Okay.
And nobody told me. I didn't have any idea. So I went back to D.C., went in to see Bauman the next morning, got there. Bauman was there. His deputy was there. The A.D., I think it was four inspectors. I thought, I must have really done something wrong. I mean, they're going to fire me. So I went in. They had me sit down. They started to interrogate me. Every time they asked me a question, I thought, they know the answer to that. It's in my background investigation. But I had to continue with this conversation. And so I had about a 90-minute interview. Finally, they conferred over in the corner, and they came back, and they said, okay, Clint, you're being assigned to Mrs. John F. Kennedy. I was devastated because I thought I was going to, if I wasn't going to be fired, I thought maybe I was going to be assigned to the president. And that's where all the action always was, all the interesting activities. I knew what the agents with Mrs. Eisenhower and Mrs. Truman had done, and there was nothing active about it at all. I mean, they'd gone to fashion shows and watched canasta games and that type of thing.
Right.
And I didn't want any part of that, and I thought, oh, boy, this is going to be a disaster for the next few years, because I didn't know anything about Mrs. Kennedy.
Right. And is the position just one agent assigned?
Two agents.
Two agents assigned.
There was a senior agent to me, was an agent in charge, and myself. And so they told me I was the junior agent. Go over there and introduce yourself to Jim Jeffries, was the name of the senior agent.
Okay.
And he'll introduce you to Mrs. Kennedy. So on Friday, when the president-elect and Mrs. Kennedy flew down from Cape Cod, where they'd been, they went over to the house, and I went over there to meet her. And Agent Jeffrey introduced me to her, and it was obvious she wasn't too happy about Secret Service being there.
Oh, okay.
And she also was very pregnant at the time. So we had kind of a short conversation, but it was pretty obvious that she was not too happy with the situation.
Were you both immediately assigned to the duty? And that was like the first time you met her, and you're saying, we're here to support you?
Oh, yeah. Jeffries just told her exactly how it was going to go, that we were the two agents that were going to work with her. Whenever she went any place, we would be with her. It would be very important if she would make sure we had all the information needed about any activity she was going to participate in and all this. And she was, you know, she had lived in D.C. long enough, and she had been around other kids that, you know, like Margaret Truman, I guess, or somebody else, but she knew what the activity level was for agents being with people, and she didn't like it at all.
it fascinates me to those first impressions and how those are, that over time you have a kind of a very different reaction to you when you first arrive and those type of things.
Yeah, it was obvious that she didn't want somebody looking over her shoulder 24 hours a day. But from that first day on, she couldn't participate in hardly any activities because of her pregnancy. But one thing she could do was go for walks.
Okay.
And she liked to walk along the canal paths in Georgetown. And so they were living at 3307 N Street Northwest, walk over to 34th Street, you could ride down to the canal path. So that's what we do every day. And during those walks, I got to know her and she got to know me. And so that was very beneficial.
Is that something through your training you kind of just talk about as far as the familiarization? Because I know there's some protectees that probably keep you maybe at an arm distance, allow you to do your job, but also too, it's one of the necessary things for them to do their job. Is there any type of training as an agent to try to familiarize yourself or to be able to, if you have that opportunity to kind of get to know the protectee, try to establish that relationship, or they just naturally happen?
It just happens kind of naturally. I mean, and it takes time. It doesn't immediately happen. I mean, we gradually became close and closer, closer as friends. I got to the point where she trusted me with anything. So, okay. And that was great. I mean, sometimes it was a little bit too much because eventually, in that case, she would go overseas, for example, and she wouldn't take any staff with her. She would take her personal assistant, who was her maid, actually, and she'd rely on me to deal with the diplomatic situations, with the social activities, with the press, with everything. I mean, so I had to really be on my game in order to fulfill all that responsibility. It got to be very trying at times, but it was interesting, too, at the same time. I'm glad she actually trusted me that much and gave me that much responsibility.
You were assigned her all the way up to and through your trip to Dallas. So pretty much that's where you saw yourself for that amount of time until you flew out to Texas to provide protection while President Kennedy was in Dallas.
Yes. In 1962, we went to India and Pakistan and Iran. And during that trip, the agent in charge was relieved of his responsibility at her request. She and the president requested that he be transferred somewhere else. And in the middle of the night, I get a telephone. I was in Karachi, Pakistan, setting up the part of the trip into Pakistan, and I get a call in the middle of the night that the embassy wants to see me right away. They got top secret messages for me and all this kind of stuff. And I go there, and the messages all said the same thing. Report to Lahore, Pakistan, immediately. Take over the responsibility for Mrs. Kennedy's continued trip. And so I replaced the agent who had been there, Jim Deffers.
And so when you're doing these travels out there or travels during the protection, you had to go to the embassy for all these official messages. And our generation has the technology and be able to do that kind of stuff, but you had, literally had to get in the vehicle and go to the embassy to receive these types of messages.
Oh, absolutely. We had no other recourse. That's the only place we could see any type of information like this. And we had to go to the embassy itself to obtain the information. We had no other resource.
So this part, I'd like to talk a bit about the day of the assassination. Again, it did happen in your life, but I don't want to spend too much specific time on that because you lived a full career with the Secret Service, but just maybe set up the event a little bit and how the morning began and then walk through the process of the 5 days that occurred afterwards and, you know, your experience and feelings through that. Because it's important, I think, for people to understand as you're going through this, how you mentally and physically got through those 5 days and kind of how in describing that to maybe the agents here today and maybe offer some guidance or wisdom and how you were able to process through that. How you were able to do your job, what you were trained to do, mm-hmm. but then some of the aftermath and what you had to do after to take care of yourself and also to take care of your fellow agents.
I was responsible for Mrs. Kennedy after 1962. I was the senior agent. I didn't even have an assistant for the first 5 or 6 months. I was with her all alone. In 1963, she became pregnant again. And so she decided that she was going to spend the summer in Hyannisport, Massachusetts. So we went there so she could just kind of lay low. What couldn't be very active. While there on August 7th, I guess it was, 1963, she was going into labor. And so we called for a helicopter to take her to Otis Air Force Base where we had established a special emergency unit just in the case of something like this. The Air Force had set it up for us, got her over there. She gave birth. It was emergency birth, and the baby had a lung problem. And the president was in the White House in Washington, and he got to the Cape as quick as he could. Just so happened that that day, Air Force One was not available because it was on a mission. And so when they got to Andrews, they had to take some smaller jets in order to get Otis quickly, which they did. When he got to Otis and talked to the doctors, they decided that they had to move the child to Boston for better medical treatment, but they couldn't do it by helicopter because of his lung condition, so had to go by ambulance. I had one other agent working with me, Paul Landis, and I had him go with the child in the ambulance to Boston, and I stayed with her at Otis, and then the detail took the president visit back to Boston to be with the child. And on the morning of August 9th, we got word at 6 o'clock in the morning, the boy, and they had named him Patrick Bouvier Kennedy, had died. It was devastating to her and to him. I mean, they had really been looking forward to this birth, and it was all shattered now. So it was really terrible. And the president came out to see her at the hospital. He had stayed in Boston, and they had a funeral service in Boston for the baby. Mrs. Kennedy couldn't even go. She was in the hospital in Otis.
Wow, okay.
So then it was just her sister who was living in London, and her sister Lee came over to be with her. And Lee suggested that maybe she should get away for a while. The president said, yeah, I think that's a good idea. We went to Athens, Greece, and went on a big ship. It was owned by Aristotle Onassis. It was named Christina. And she had with her Franklin D. Roosevelt Jr. and his wife and some other friends. But we were there for about almost 2 weeks. And during that time, she really got much better. The depression kind of lifted. And on the way back to the States, we were flying commercial. Whenever Mrs. Kennedy flew, other than in the United States, she would fly on the family's private plane, the Caroline. But if we went internationally, we flew commercial. And so we were flying back commercial, and she called me into where she was seated, and she said, I'm going to go with the president. He's going on a trip into Texas. What had happened was the president had been in Texas in June, and he had been down in El Paso, and he had met with the Vice President Johnson and the governor, and they decided to have a campaign trip into the South, specifically Texas and Florida, pre-1964, because they needed electoral votes from those two states in order to get reelected. They were concerned about it. And so the trip was scheduled for November 21, 22, 23. I guess we're going back the 23rd or 24th. We're going to go to San Antonio, Houston, Fort Worth, Dallas, Austin, the LBJ Ranch, and then back to Washington, D.C. So on the morning of the 22nd, we were at that time in Fort Worth. We were staying at the Hotel Texas. Our next stop, the president was going to do a breakfast that morning at the hotel. We were going to then go by motorcade to get on Air Force One, which is kind of ridiculous to fly from Fort Worth to Dallas. When we got up that morning in Fort Worth, first thing that happened was we were shown a poster that was being passed around in Dallas. And the poster was a photo of President Kennedy, and it said wanted for treason. And it specified certain things. And so we knew this trip into Dallas was going to be more difficult than we originally anticipated. We always knew that there was a certain fringe element in the Dallas area that really detested President Kennedy. The United States Ambassador, Adlai Stevenson, he was the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, had gone to Texas to speak about 6 weeks before this trip in October, I think it was 1963. He was making a speech. They heckled him off the stage. He had to quit the speech. A woman hit him on the head with a placard. I mean, it got pretty physical. And so the chief of police, Chief Curry, was very concerned about how the reaction was going to be with the people of Dallas. On the night of November 21st, while we were in Fort Worth over in Dallas, Curry went on TV and pleaded with the people of Dallas to show respect. We knew there was a possibility of that kind of problem. We fly over to Dallas and go to Love Field. It took us about 10 minutes. There was a big crowd at Love Field. We had flown two cars in. They had first been used in San Antonio, and now they've been moved to Dallas. One of them was 100X. Follow-up car was, I think it was 679. And so we started the motorcade from Love Field. Weather was pretty nice, but this was one of these maximum exposure trips. The president had said he didn't want people up on the car because he didn't want it to appear that there was anything between him and the voter, people who were on the sidelines, to see him. And he was afraid that if we were up there hovering, what he said called hovering, they would get the impression that he was something other than being just a normal human.
Someone that could be approachable?
Yeah. He didn't want that. And I could understand it. So we started in this motorcade, and the crowd started to build right outside of Love Field from that point on all the way into downtown. We got to Main Street, and the crowd was extremely large. Both sides of the street, some places it was 10, 20 deep, couldn't be contained on the sidewalk. Buildings, mostly high-rise structures, and there were people hanging out of the windows and on rooftops or on fire escapes. Because of the size of the crowd and everything, the driver, Bill Greer, was keeping the presidential vehicle to the left-hand side of the street, keeping the president, who was in the right rear, away from the crowd on the right side. But that put Mrs. Kennedy right up next to the crowd on the left-hand side.
Okay.
And so I was working the follow-up car. I was on the left-hand side on the running board. It's an open car. I would get off the follow-up car and go up and get on the top of the back of the presidential limousine to be as close to Mrs. Kennedy as I could when Greer would do that, so that if anybody in that crowd tried something, I'd at least be close enough so I could try to intercede, not, to protect her in some way. whatever way I could. So a net went on all the way down Main Street. I'd be on the car, the crowd would drop off a little bit. I'd be back to the follow-up car, and then the crowd would grow, and the same thing would happen. It happened about four times or so, five maybe. We get to the end of Main Street, and we had to turn right, a street called Houston Street. And then we were going to turn left on a street called Elm. The distance of Houston was one block from Main to Elm. At the corner of Elm and Houston sat this one building called the Texas School Book Depository, about seven stories high. It was a storage warehouse for school books. So we were going down Houston Street toward that building, toward Elm Street. And we noticed most of the windows on that particular building were closed. There were like three windows open. On one of the windows, we could see that there were some maintenance people having lunch. They were eating sandwiches, and they were just watching the motorcade. But we didn't see anybody in any of the other windows. So we never, you know, everything looked okay to us. And the crowd dropped off completely just in that area. There were very few people. And we entered an area called Dealey Plaza. And when we turned left on Elm, going into the Dealey Plaza area, it was a very sharp turn, more than 90 degrees. I mean, it's very sharp. So when we got straightened out going down Elm Street, and I was surveying the area to the left, this grassy area, there were people there taking photographs and stuff, and we were going to have to go over under an overpass, a railroad overpass that was straight in front of us, but there was a police officer up there I could see, and some people, but it didn't seem to be anything of concern. And I'm looking around, and all of a sudden, we're about 150 feet, maybe 120 feet down from the corner of Houston onto Elm, and over my right shoulder, I heard this explosive noise. Initially, I didn't identify it as a gunshot, so I started to turn toward it. I only got as far as a presidential vehicle with my eyes, because I saw what the president did. He reacted to that noise by grabbing his throat, and then he started to fall to his left. I then realized it was a gunshot. And so I jumped from my position and started to run. The noise from the motorcycle and the follow-up car precluded my hearing the second shot that had been fired as I ran toward the presidential vehicle. So I had to maneuver between the motorcycle officer and the car I was on, and there was lots of engine noise and stuff. And as I approached the presidential car, trying to get up on the back of it, just before I got there, there was another explosive noise. This time, president was hit in the head. And at that time, his head was in a downward kind of position like this, and his left cheek was right against Mrs. Kennedy's cheek. I mean, they were heads almost together, touching. Bullet entered the lower portion of the head, but it exited above the right ear, right rear of the skull, and it was a massive eruption of material. The skull fractured up at this point. A portion of it flipped forward with portion of the scalp. Material just erupted out of that wound, blood, brain matter, bone fragments, all over the back of the car, all over me, all over Mrs. Kennedy. And about that time, Bill Greer, the driver, hit the gas. And I had just got my foot up on the foothold on the back of the presidential vehicle when he hit the gas, so I slipped off. So if you watch the Zapruder film, you'll see that I have to run about two or three steps in order to get back up on there.
Right.
About that time, Mrs. Kennedy came up on the trunk, and she was grasping at all this material that was up there because it was part of her husband, and she
in the state of shock.
No, absolutely. In a state of shock. She didn't realize what she was doing, and she grabbed a hold of some of that stuff, and I finally got up on top of the back of the car, grabbed a hold of her, and put her in the back seat. As soon as she got in the back seat, the president's body fell to its left with his head in her lap, and his right side of his face was up. I could see his eyes were fixed. I could see into that wound in the skull. There was no brain matter there left at all, so I assumed it was a fatal wound. I didn't think there was a possibility of him still being alive, and so I turned and gave a thumbs down to the follow-up car crew, because I wanted to make sure they understood how serious this was. Then I screamed at the driver to get us to a hospital. Chief Curry, who was driving the lead car, got in front of us, led us to a Parkland hospital. We were running, I don't know, 70, 80 miles an hour trying to get there. We get to the hospital. There's nobody there to meet us. Advance agent Wynn Lawson got out of the lead car, ran into the hospital, found that there was an attendant trying to bring out some gurneys, but he got caught in the doorway because he had two of them. Because what had happened was, apparently the police notified the hospital that we were on our way and that they thought they had two patients, Governor being one, and that was true. He had also been hit. Finally, then it got the gurneys out, and so then we were going to do what we could for him. But the first thing we had to do was get the governor out of the car, because the way the car was configured, Governor Connally was sitting right in front of President Kennedy. the back of Governor Connally's seat right up against President Kennedy's knees.
Okay.
So we couldn't help the president unless we got Connally out of the car. So we had to lift Connally up first, put him on a gurney, and get him into the emergency room. When we did that, Mrs. Connally just ran in with him. We were going to help President Kennedy, and Mrs. Kennedy had a hold of him, and she didn't want to let go. So I pleaded with her. I said, Mrs. Kennedy, please let us help the president. Didn't get a response of any kind. I pleaded with her again. Nothing. So then I remembered now, been with her for about 3 years. She was probably concerned that how he appeared, and it was terrible, to be honest with you. And I could understand that after witnessing it myself. And so I took off my suit coat and I covered up his head so nobody could see it. And his upper back, she let go right away. So we lifted him up, put him on a gurney, ran into the emergency room, put him in trauma room one. We no more than got in there than the doctors started arriving from all over the hospital. Agent Kellerman, who was the senior supervisor on this trip, yelled at me, said, open a phone line to the White House. Tell them exactly what's going on. So I went to the nurse's administrative desk there in the emergency room and got one of their phones, called the Dallas switchboard because a walk had established a switchboard in Dallas. And I got the operator and told him who I was and what I needed. I needed him to open the line to the White House in Washington to keep it open. Don't let anybody else use it. So I'm talking to Jerry Bain back at the White House in Washington, explaining everything, what's going on. And all of a sudden, the operator cuts in and says, Mr. Hill, the Attorney General wants to talk to you. Now, that was President Kennedy's brother, Bobby. I said, okay. So I said, Mr. Attorney General, what can I do for you? He said, Clint, he said, what's going on down there? So I told him that the president had been shot. Governor had been shot. We're in the emergency room. He said, well, how bad is it? I didn't want to tell him that his brother was dead. So I just said, it's as bad as it can get. I heard a clink. He just hung up the phone.
Oh.
That's how he found out. The doctor came out of the trauma room where they'd been working feverishly on President Kennedy, realized such a massive wound as he had in his upper skull. The doctors never even turned him over to see if he'd been hit anyplace else. They did notice that there was they tried to do a tracheotomy. So they opened an area in his throat where actually there was an exit wound in his throat from the first shot that hit him at about the neckline or a little bit below, exited the throat. And if that would have been the only shot that hit him, he would have survived it. It wasn't that serious. But they didn't realize exactly what they were doing, and they opened that wound up and used it to do a tracheotomy.
Mm.
And so that became an issue regarding in the autopsy. So then after the doctor made the announcement that the president's dead, Kenny O'Donnell, who's the chief of staff, came out and said, Clint, we need a casket to get the president's body back to Washington.
And that's the realization that sets in right after that moment. You got to start thinking ahead, even though that, you know, this is all taking place, the president's shot, but you still have a mission, you have a duty, you still have to take care of.
And there was no time for anything else. I mean, you just had to keep going.
Right.
And so that's what we did. And I'd never been to Dallas before. So I had got a hold of the hospital administrator, had them connect me with a mortuary, and I got a hold of them and told them I needed the best casket they had and delivered it to Parkland Hospital in my name. And I signed for it, and they did it. Then when they got it there, the nurses started to prepare the president's body for transporting back to D.C.
Well, I do want to say thank you. I know it gets hard, and it's a challenge, and it's tough, but having the personal courage, because I know this isn't the only time you've had to say and talk about this. However, I know it doesn't get easier to be able to keep saying this and talking, but I do appreciate you taking the time and being able to share that with us. So thank you.
I'm glad I could relate it to you.
When the incident occurred in Dallas, did your team do anything? And you don't have to answer this. I just wanted to know if, like, the protection detail, did you do anything in remembrance for him? Was there anything specially that you did for?
We didn't have a time to do anything.
Okay.
But instantaneously, when the doctor said the president has died, all the agents, with the exception of myself, my assistant, Paul Landis, the supervisor agent, Roy Kellerman, and the driver, Bill Greer, everybody else immediately went to Vice President Johnson.
Okay.
They took him out to Love Field and put him on Air Force One. When we finally cleared the Parkland Hospital with the president's body, we drove to Parkland and got on Air Force One also. And from that point on, it was just the four of us really got to Andrews. We took the president's body to Bethesda. It was Kellerman, Greer, myself, and Landis. Everybody else was with now President Johnson, because President Johnson was sworn in on Air Force One on the ground in Dallas.
I would like to give a special thanks to Mr. Clint Hill and his writer, Lisa McCubbin, for making this interview possible. If you'd like to know more about Mr. Hill or Lisa McCubbin, simply search for their names on any internet search engine. There you will find everything you need to know about this Secret Service hero. Please join us for part two of our interview with Mr. Clint Hill next month. Thank you for joining us. Until next time, stay vigilant.